Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Bob Mankoff, who is the cartoon editor of the New Yorker magazine. He has a book, a memoir, How About Never? Is Never Good for You? My Life in Cartoons. Bob Mankoff started out in psychology, has an all but PhD in psychology. You've been the cartoon editor since 1997, and before that you were drawing cartoons for The New Yorker.
Since 1977.
Also the founder of the Cartoon Bank, which has become more important over the years, particularly for artists who now have a place to sell their material since magazines have died.
Not The New Yorker, still alive and kicking, but the Cartoon Bank, where you can license any of the cartoons you hear on this wonderful radio show, and in which the artists get a very, very good cut, actually 55% of the revenue for licensed cartoons, which is pretty good.
People are constantly sharing cartoons. What percentage of, say, Facebook cartoons that we see actually come from directly from or indirectly from the Cartoon Bank, you think?
Well, I would think I have actually no particular idea, but New Yorker cartoons are constantly being shared and enjoyed. That's really no problem for me. I don't expect to get money for when someone shares a cartoon. Usually they're sharing really a link from the Cartoon Bank. The deal is, you know, if you're making money off of it, the artist should make money. So if you're making money, then they deserve a cut. That's their intellectual property. The cartoonist actually owns the copyright, not The New Yorker, for the cartoons. The New Yorker, through the Cartoon Bank, licenses it. You know, it's important if you still want to see cartoons, you don't want it just to turn into a hobby, you know, you should contribute to that profession.
Bob Mankoff, let's talk about your memoir, How About Never Is Never Good for You. That's probably your most famous caption. Describe the cartoon and also why you made the choice to make this really strange title for your book.
One word, marketing. The cartoon itself that I drew in 1993 was published on May 5th, 1993, and has since been reprinted thousands of times. It's an executive. He's on the phone. He's looking at his appointment book, and he's saying, no, Thursday's out. How about never? It's never good for you. And that cartoon, the phrase, how about never is never good for you, is now in the Yale Book of Quotations. It's ripped off on T-shirts. Well, I'm pursuing that now. It's even on thongs. So the reason why it's the strange title of the book is because the phrase itself is known so well, and it gets people's attention in addition to this lovely cover of the book, which you can't see, which has me at a door with all the characters in The New Yorker behind me.
Let's delve into that particular cartoon. You talk about it, of course, in the book. But Bob Mankoff, how did you come up with that caption?
Well, rather unusual, because most of the ideas or cartoons that I have, and I've had over 950 in the magazine, don't come from actual conversation or experience. That one happened, too, because I was on the phone with someone who was blowing me off, and I just ended up saying to him, how about never? It's never good for you. And I had done between 10 and 15 cartoons already for that week's submissions, and that's an interesting thing, or I think you would find intriguing thing in the book, that a cartoonist does not do one idea a week. A cartoonist does lots and lots of ideas, and I just threw that in. Tina Brown, who was the editor at the time, loved it so much that she immediately wanted it published in the magazine. That's how it came to be. Just a little comedy wonkiness about it. Well, why is it a good cartoon to the extent that it is? What does it do? It's this mashup of something we'd like to express. It's what humor does. It combines two opposite things, which is you have the syntax of politeness and the message is rude. That's why you need at the end of it is never good for you. You could have a joke if you just said, no Thursdays out, how about never? It wouldn't be as good a joke because you wouldn't have this sort of cognitive synergy of these two opposing forces.
Do you think that the mashup of ideas, the role of incongruity, which is what you call it in the book, do you think that sits at the heart of humor?
I think at the real heart of humor, the actual heart, is surprise. Surprise, to get all wonky, philosophical, academic, surprise is always bad for an organism. You should never be surprised. Your initial response to surprise is always slightly negative. What's going on? So you see it in peekaboo. You see it in relief humor and stuff. Incongruity is a version of surprise. It's a more cognitive version, where we're artificially putting things together. You know, all of a sudden you see a cartoon of mine, and it's called What Lemmings Believe, and they're going up. Now you put together these different frames of reference at the same point. Your very initial psychological reaction is, what is this? When the surprise turns out not to be negative, and there's pleasure associated with it, of a cognitive thrill of putting together, ideas are put together, or a foe is diminished, or an idea you have is supported. All of that contributes to humor. That's comedy. At the heart of humor is surprise. So I say incongruity by itself usually is not funny. If I just say, okay, I'm looking at something. I have a traveling case. I want 16 bananas now. I want a picture of Donald Sterling. That's all certainly incongruous. Not funny, though. Maybe since Donald Sterling is automatic punchline now, it would be. Often people confuse enhancements or inhibitors for humor itself. We're social animals. Laughter is an emotional regulation mechanism. We're not going to be laughing that much here because we're just talking. It's transactional. It's informational. But when you go out and when you talk to someone, if you look at laughter occurs about 10 or 15 times in normal conversation in any 5-minute period. So a lot of times just all these things, just simply little social tension, anxiety, embarrassment, any of that can sort of result in laughter. That's different than comedy. Comedy is sort of this artificial art that creates laughter.
Let's get back to your example. Pieces of luggage, 12 bananas, and Donald Sterling.
Right.
I would assume there's a way to turn that into comedy.
But that would mean you would have to use that setup as some punchline that somehow drew these references together. It would be like our caption contest. It would be very difficult, though. And the more objects I added, okay, now we have bananas, luggage, Donald Sterling, we have a bowling ball, we have a ticket to a Yankee game. Now we have more and more incongruity. In fact, Mankoff's law is that the number of frames of reference that you have to coordinate is inversely proportional to your ability to make the joke.
On the other hand, when you began adding things, I started to laugh.
You started to laugh at it because what I was creating, as I added that, we moved from what's called in psychology a telic frame mode, which is purposeful, to a play mode. I just started to kid around. That itself, once I move into a play frame, you'll start to think it's funny. Now, partly you also think it's funny simply because of the psychological phenomenon called generalization. It starts to look like a joke. When I was in psychology, if you teach a pigeon to peck at a red disc, it'll also peck at an orange one. And as you go with that. So that's why lots of humor, you know, probably when you were growing up, you know, you had this, like, meta joke where, and so the lion and then a zebra comes over and the lion says to the zebra, no soap radio. Okay, it sort of feels like it's a joke because you've seen structures of jokes. You sort of react to it as a joke if I play around. So I think that's what you were doing there. And I only know you for 5 minutes. I'd have to talk to your therapist for sure. As I said, humors operate by surprise. In cognitive psychology, they would be related to schemas. In other words, we know what it is to go into a restaurant. We know what it is to be in an airport. We have general expectations. That's how we operate most of the time, sort of on automatic pilot. Humor takes us out of this automatic pilot by switching the narrative. It can be quite wonderful in that all of a sudden it awakens us. It can awaken us when we're born. I was in the airport because I'd been on this book tour, and the guy was saying, please, you know, watch your unattended belongings. You know, they may be confiscated, damaged, destroyed. And then I just said, eaten. And it made me laugh because it just seems so ridiculous. All of a sudden, if you heard that. Now, in my mind, it was funny. If he had said that, everyone would have been terrified. They would know that someone had taken over inappropriately in an airport the PA system.
But you can also see on some level that there would be a way for Bob Mankoff to turn that somehow into a cartoon if you could figure it out.
That's my job. That's the burden I have as a humorist, to turn ordinary absurdity and insanity into comedy and to turn pain into pleasure. Because all humor is about, all real deep humor, the humor we laugh at deeply, is about discomfort, embarrassment, and pain looked at in another perspective. That's one of the functions of humor. Its primary function is not entertainment. I don't believe. I think its primary functions are two. One is coping. simply taking to that. And the other is actually ridicule and conformity, which is not so pleasant. But you know, if you've been to public school and elementary school, you know how humor is actually used. It's not used subversively. It is used a little bit subversively, but mainly to keep people in line. When people ask, when you think of what things are funny, things that are embarrassing. I often do this in a class I taught at the University of Michigan. I say, hey, tell me something funny that happened to you. And invariably, it's something that's embarrassing looked at from a different perspective. And so embarrassment is we don't want to be embarrassed. But what's the policeman of embarrassment? Laughter.
When you talk about turning discomfort into humor, is that why you think for a long time may still be true Jewish humor or African-American humor, that there are more comedians, stand-up comedians, who are Jewish and African-Americans than, say, Protestant?
Well, absolutely, and much more Jews than African-Americans also. I mean, now that changes because now comedy has become sort of a profession. Everybody knows. It's almost a derivative form. You watch thousands of YouTube videos, you think you could do that. But its real origins before this stand-up in Eastern Europe are in this crucible of comedy in which you have Jews who have an intellectual tradition of sort of this logic chopping, the Talmud, which is almost seems like jokes themselves, how crazy it can get, flipping things one way and the other. They're a minority, disliked and persecuted by the majority. They feel both inferior and superior to that majority because they're better educated. They feel a conflict because they're the chosen people, but they wish that God maybe had chosen someone else. They have conflict within their own sects between the Orthodox, the Hasidic, and the assimilationists. So all of this conflict, combined with powerlessness, leads them to use humor as a tool. Then it's got transferred to the United States, and by 1979, 80% of the people in comedy were Jewish. And I talk about that in a book, My Jewish Background, and how I think it helped me certainly in terms of humor.
Well, it also meant when I moved to California and had a thick New York accent, people were going, oh, my God, you're like Woody Allen.
Right, right. And they immediately put you into that category. And, you know, Woody Allen was a great comedian, a great humorist, and took, in a way, Jewish humor to a new level because he put a whole intellectual veneer, if you will, on it. As we talked about this combinatorial aspect of humor, in Eastern Europe, you know, it could have been jokes about assimilation. It was directed by Jews at Jews and also by Jews to the wider, you know, community, the quote-unquote goyim. So that was interesting about Jewish humor. It was both self-deprecating, so, you know, the couple converts, they go into the country club, they're all fancified, and the woman jumps in the pool, it's very cold, she says, Oy gevolt, not that I know what that means. But what Woody Allen is, he took Jewish humor out of its Jewishness, although there's still that whole neurotic center, and could talk about philosophy and science right. And everything else.
Bob Mankoff, let me ask you about timing. You know, I talked to Dave Barry, who writes humor. For him, the hardest thing about writing humor is understanding that he doesn't have timing. When we look at, if you go back a few years, right. Jack Benny.
Right, right.
Right. Jack Benny wouldn't have to speak, but just by the most imperceptible gestures, he would get people to laugh.
Right.
And, of course, we know watching any stand-up, how they phrase and when they say things has a lot to do with laughter. How does timing play into cartoons, does
it? Well, I think it plays into it well because you have setup and punchline. You have delay. First thing people see is the image. They see that guy there. Then what you do is you play with the structure of the sentences. So no Thursdays out. That's setup. You have some delay. How about never? Then there's a dash. It's a long dash. It's never good for you. Often, of course, you use classic triplets. Like in an Alex Gregory cartoon of two women, and they're dining, and he says, I started my vegetarianism for moral reasons, then for health concerns, and now it's just to annoy people. So you do have the timing. I use timing in the book in that, which I think is interesting in this book, there's a constant interplay of images. I break up sentences. The sentence in the book, you'll see a sentence will run into a cartoon, and then the punchline will be after it. So timing is rhythm. I've been having an interesting experience with a joke. I do a lot of presentations. So it was interesting. It's sort of like a Jack Benny thing. I show a slide, and I talk about the sensitivity of the New Yorker readers. And there's a slide in which there's a little rodent, and the lab guy is looking at him. He's in the cage, and the rat has hung himself. Okay, so the punchline for the cartoon is discouraging data on the antidepressant. Everybody laughs at that. Then I show on online surveys the variety of people's responses. So a lot of people like it, but one person, they can rates it a 3. I don't like to see animals suffer even in cartoons. Okay, and so that sort of makes people laugh. So my original joke that I've been telling, which is a setup and a punchline, is I used to say fairly quickly, they don't suffer, we use anesthetic ink. Okay, and that got a laugh. Lately, though, what I did, I just look at them and I say, they don't suffer. And then I let it pause. It sinks into them. They then construct their own scenario of course they don't suffer. It's a cartoon. No one is suffering. Then I say the punchline. Sometimes it raises it to 11, and sometimes it gets less of a laugh. It was funny. When you do in performance, you can find out things you can't find out in writing. See, when I do, they don't suffer, they use anesthetic, I do the whole joke for you. When I say very slowly, they don't suffer, and I look at you, it sinks in, and then your mind starts working. You create scenario, and probably made the scenarios a little bit different. So that's an interesting stuff I've been discovering on this tour.
Several years ago, I interviewed Michael Frayn, and we talked about Noises Off. And if you see a good performance of Noises Off, you're rolling on the floor laughing. If you see a bad performance where the timing is a little bit off or people say something, the audience is dead throughout, absolutely dead. And he saw a performance like that, and he was able to describe it. So something is going on that transcends, say, the printed page when you're talking about live stuff. But you don't have that option, obviously, in a cartoon.
Well, that's interesting. So what you don't have in the cartoons, for the most part, is the usual enhancers that stimulate humor, which is simply being in front of an audience. An audience itself is like a tinderbox ready to explode in laughter.
That also goes back to the old situation comedies and the canned laughter. They would put it in hoping the audience laugh.
Hoping the audience laugh or stimulating that. So you don't have any contagion of laughter when you're sitting. Humor is basically a social phenomenon. The reason laughter is loud is it's a communication device. It says either we're bonding, we're having fun, we're doing that. People do not laugh at cartoons or very, very rarely when they are by themselves. So you no longer have all these enhancing factors. You don't have the enhancing factor of it's an audience. As an audience, they are being restricted in that they have one response, laughter, and while you talk. We don't have that, and therefore the cartoons don't have the usual levers, so we have to actually depend much more on the actual content, cognitive content of the joke. You can make people laugh very easily in an audience. I don't mean to make it seem completely simple, but book passage, I'm the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. You've come to see me. You like The New Yorker cartoons. You like me. All of these factors take very, very little for me to engender laughter. That laughter would not be transferable, me doing the same things, because there, to really enjoy that, you had to be there. In a cartoon, the cartoon has to create that all by itself.
I want to ask a little about political humor. Right-wingers versus progressives. You know, right-wingers laugh when Rush Limbaugh talks. They think he's a comedian. They won't necessarily laugh at Jon Stewart, or maybe they will. I don't know.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. What do you think that's about?
That's about dispositional humor. That's about the fact that, and there's lots of experiments on this, is that, I mean, to simplify enormously, is forget Jon Stewart, forget Rush Limbaugh. When your friend makes fun of your enemy, it's funny. The reverse isn't true. The fact is, it's often very difficult for you to think funny about anything that you deeply care about. To the extent that you have a position about global warming, about nuclear disarmament, about Obama, as I said, humor is social. Let's look at one of its prime functions. Its prime functions is to deflate ridicule. Well, you don't want your pet idea deflated. You want the other person's. Those are the enhancers and inhibitors. That's not humor itself. Humor is that little triangle in the beginning, whether it's Rush Limbaugh or Jon Stewart, in which there's the setup and the punchline and something else is going on. Jon Stewart would make fun of Jim Cramer, but he couldn't make fun of him simply by saying, okay, I'm Jon Stewart, you like me, you don't like Jim Cramer, Jim Cramer's a jerk. That's not a joke. Okay?
Right.
He would need to do something else, but he wouldn't need to do very much when you're already disposed.
Do you think that because, say, the Tea Party and people like Sarah Palin or Donald Sterling are so outrageous in what they say that on some level, it takes away from somebody's ability to be funny because, I mean, my God, you can't get any more bizarre in Congress than things they say.
People on the other side would say the same thing about people. That's what you have to realize about perspective. But that's certainly not the case. Tina Fey basically lampooned Sarah Palin by pretty much saying exactly. Jon Stewart pretty much did that with Jim Cramer simply by showing his own videos. I think the real humor is not so much for me, is just in the absurdity that exists in the ordinary, in our lives, in everything, in airports, just walking around, just listening to the people on the airplane telling me that, you know, my seat can also be used as a flotation device. Is that supposed to be uplifting? Is that supposed to make me feel hopeful? Has anyone flutter kicked to safety in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean? You know, the idea that there are, that they inform you this is a no-smoking flight. I'm going to, oh, my goodness, I thought this was a smoking flight. Please get me on the smoke. There aren't any more smoking flights.
Bob Mankoff, The New Yorker. You talk in your book, How About Never Is Never Good For You. You talk about how various cartoons come to be. You talk about how you choose cartoons, which mostly means sitting down with the current editor, David Remnick, and a third party, and just kind of going through it and figuring things out. Have you ever come across a cartoon where Remnick or you laughed hysterically and the other person said, I don't get it, even after you explained it?
Well, usually after you explain it, people get it. But if you don't, if you don't put together the different frames of reference or get the idea within less than half a second, then it's not going to be funny for you, even if you understand it after. Actually, the selection process is actually quite different in that I do bring 40 or 50 into David and Sylvia Killingsworth, who's the managing editor. But before that, I get to see 500 or 1,000 cartoons, and I mentor people, and people come in. And so there's quite an elaborate process, and I do have a philosophy of the different type of cartoons I'm looking for. David Remnick doesn't have to be burdened with this part. What he wants is my help in my selection, and then he can make his selection. I look at cartoons, and I say, okay, is this just a joke? Is there any value over and above this joke? Then it's got to be a really good joke. Is this actually something that makes a point that hasn't been made before? Is it something besides the cartoon, you know, going on? Is it a cartoon that's basically tech-centric? It's all basically a quip, and it would be okay even if you didn't see it.
And I've seen those.
Yeah, absolutely. No Thursdays Out, How About Never Is Never Good For You. It's pretty much that type of cartoon. That's very different than a cartoon in which is like our caption contest, in which the image and the caption has to combine. Neither one of them is funny. It is not in no way funny, the line, we've child-proofed our home. It is funny if it's a couple talking to another couple and outside the window there's the children pressed up against trying to get in. Okay, so I and David and the New Yorker, we're looking for an eclectic range, something that shows that humor is a mansion with many rooms. And there's lots of different ways of being funny. There's lots of different personalities that express humor. I think that's what makes it unique about The New Yorker. We do not look at the cartoons as a commodity.
But you also have to ensure that a cartoon has to be such that the Rush Limbaugh people and, you know, the Jon Stewart people will both laugh. And that if it's...
Well, for the most part, that's the case, because the New Yorker cartoons, when they do target, they target the class that is reading it. And they can make them laugh at their own foibles. When I do a cartoon and where it's two business guys, one is saying to the other, how you doing? I say, oh, I can't complain, but I do. That's universal. And that's when people say to me, you have the best job in the world. I do have a great, great job, but do I complain? All the time. You know, the New Yorker's problems that exist in the New Yorker within the cartoons are first world problems. You know, they're the problems that I have when I got a single cup coffee maker and I put the thing in there and I'm pissed because I'm not getting a full cup. It's like going three quarters and it's aesthetically bothering me. And I'm complaining to my wife. I said, what is it with this? You know, there's a Bruce Eric Kaplan cartoon that goes by the name Beck, in which there's a woman at a restaurant saying, excuse me, waiter, there's something imperceptibly wrong with this dish that no one other than me could possibly have a problem with. So I think most of our cartoons are like that. Most of the cartoons are about the foibles and weaknesses that everyone have. And, interestingly, the cartoons that have a sort of a political slant often go against the grain of the New Yorker's own ethos. I did a cartoon where there's a woman saying to another woman at a bar, "I hate to admit it, but a man with a big carbon footprint makes me hot." Or another one by Alex Gregory with his two cavemen, one saying to the other, "I don't understand it. Air is pure. The water is clean. Everything we eat is organic, and we only live to be 30.
Bob Mankoff, you also talk a lot in the book about the New Yorker contest, which is such a brilliant idea. And one thing it got me thinking of is it forces us, if we're doing the contest, it forces us to think about what's funny and how to create it. And you go through various various areas, including the possibility of trying to topicalize something. Yeah. It sounds like one of the things to do, if you're interested in actually making it funny and possibly winning, or to me, coming in third.
Coming up with at least a good caption.
Right. Is to start by just thinking about stuff and just throw stuff out. And when you've got 20 or 30 or 40 ideas, then you begin to narrow it down.
Right. The best idea is to get a good caption like that. Sometimes that happens. The next best idea is, what is actually going on here? So in a recent caption, there's the cubicle, and the cubicle actually is a grave. It's got a tombstone. And you want to start to associate, this guy was buried. Did he work too long? Is he an example? One of the things you want to do is get as many associations. Not necessarily to write them down, but don't look at it blankly. Then one of the other ideas is, you're out here looking at these two people looking at a cubicle gravestone. Put yourself there. Imaginatively, walk and look at it. That creates more tension in your part. You get better at doing something by doing it. So entering the contest every week, looking, trying each time, you will get better at it. And then create as much as you can. You can use tricks. One trick is try to come up with the worst caption. In other words, lower the bar there. Because if you actually think I have to come up with something good, within humor that becomes, difficult. Relax, give it a try, and do it a lot, and you'll do better at it. Will you win? Very hard. There's 5,000 or 10,000 entries, and the subjective, the process of even judging is actually extraordinarily difficult. We do give it our absolute best shot. We look at all of them anonymously. I talk about various computer programs we do. Then for any bunch of them, my assistant gives me what I call the comic landscape. I select about 7 or 10, go on SurveyMonkey, send out to New Yorker editors, come back. So it's the New Yorker. Even on this little silly thing, we give it our best shot.
You know, the picture itself that people see could come from somebody who has no idea what a caption would be, also someone who actually has a caption in their head, and you say, well, let's see what the audience does. When you've done that, have you ever had people, or what percentage in your mind do you get of people who will come back with the exact caption that the writer intended?
You always get that. There's 5,000 or 10,000 people. The cartoonist is doing the heavy lifting by creating the situation that you would never have thought of.
Would you ever put that particular one in there?
Every once in a while we do that. Remember, the cartoonist is doing 10 or 15 ideas. Often the one that we select for the caption contest is one that didn't quite make it. And so it's false to think that if you win the caption contest, you're a cartoonist. What we do know now from something like this is, look, there's a million people reading the magazine. You do the heavy lifting by you create this. You're going to actually have someone come up with a caption, and you may have someone come up, or very often, with a better caption than you did in this particular instance. That would be the case almost with anything, I think, if you could actually do it. The caption contest lends itself. If you really could send out to a million readers their best idea for a radio show, maybe their best idea for a talk piece, but there's no way that you could filter that. Because we have the software to see 10,000 captions and look at it, we're able to see, to really pick sort of the cream of the crop.
Have you ever had a situation where you look at a caption? I mean, you're going through a certain phase. You look at a caption, it's different from all the others. It's something nobody ever would have thought of, and you and Remnick just fall on the floor laughing because it's that good.
Or it could just be that strange or that unexpected. it would be, you'd fall, you may be falling on the floor for things that no one else would fall on the floor for, because you have been so inundated with so much. So it can just be surprise sort of working for you, or it can be transgression or obscenity. Generally, that doesn't happen. It doesn't mean that the cartoon isn't great, but you're in an evaluative phase, and usually what happens, you don't fall, you will laugh and stuff, but what you'll say is, that's great.
Do you remember the cartoon that got the most of the best captions from more people?
I don't think, for the most part, they are great cartoons. I think they're okay. They sort of solve this incongruity problem. I know there was one, Peter Vay drew a cartoon where there's a guy, he's at an ordinary desk, but he's got the cap on that, you know, when you get electrocuted, and he's just on the phone saying, cancel my 12 o'clock.
You did a chapter on cartoons that didn't make it, and I noticed that a couple of them, the older ones, wound up, I think, in the National Lampoon. There was one cartoon in there, a frog.
Try a frog's leg, and the frog is coming out. He's an amputee on the little thing. And that was a classic cartoon that occurred, that was in the National Lampoon, probably in 1978. Great cartoon, but certainly in 1978, inappropriate to the New Yorker. The National Lampoon is an isolated comedy environment. It's like going to a comedy club. You actually expect transgression, and people want transgression, but they want it in an isolated environment. They don't want it when they're reading about autoimmune diseases or starvation in Africa, because they're in a serious frame, and it seems, on a simple basis, it doesn't work.
How long did it take you in those 20 years before you became the cartoon editor to actually figure out, to be able to point and go, this is not the New Yorker, this is the New Yorker?
I think fairly soon it's like incorporating this, you know, it's Freudian, the superego of the New Yorker quickly gets into your head. By reading the New Yorker, by seeing what's in it, you quickly assimilate it. I think it might be something like, I don't know, you came from New York and you moved to San Francisco or California, and it took you a while, but eventually you knew what a San Francisco vibe was. You know how the people are here and how they're reacting to stuff, and it doesn't look like you modified your accent too much, but probably a few other things.
Bob Mankoff, humor changes? Does it stay the same? I mean, what makes us laugh today that didn't make us laugh 20 years ago or 40 years ago? What makes us...
I think definitely meta-humor makes us laugh, humor about humor, jokes about jokes. That would have been very, very rare. You know, we have a caption contest, and there's an anti-caption contest, which is the worst thing. There's a literal caption contest, which is just called themonkeysyouordered.com, in which simply it's in. So in our caption contest, it might have two people in heaven, sort of angels, but they have they don't have wings, they have bicycles. And so the real winner for our contest might be, I was expecting eternal rest, okay? For the literal caption contest, it would be, we have bicycles instead of wings. For the contest called What a Misunderstanding, which is by Corey Archangel, the digital, it's always the same caption, which is What a Misunderstanding. Or the another one for Universal is Christ, What an Asshole. So this is meta-humor. This is humor about humor. In the book also, I talk about mashing up Kanye West tweets with New Yorker cartoons that don't make any sense at all. The humor is really, you're making fun both of Kanye West and the New Yorker.
I saw online somebody doing that, taking quotes from True Detective and sticking them on Family Circus.
Exactly. There's a Nietzsche Family Circus also. It's not straight incongruity, because if you just saw that by itself accidentally occurring, you wouldn't think anything. It's social. You know someone is doing it. That's the joke. And that's the difference in that type of humor. They're doing it, and you are appreciating it in a certain way. What you're doing is engaging in humor play. They're not real jokes. Because they're not real jokes and they look the form of joke, they become a joke. That's what the meta part about it.
How come the Marx Brothers are still funny, yet I suspect if we saw Olsen and Johnson, we wouldn't laugh?
I don't know that the Marx Brothers are still funny. They're still funny to you. They were very much of a moment when Groucho was deconstructing English and fooling around with it. I taught a class at the University of Michigan, and I would show Buster Keaton and Charlie Chaplin films that I'm great fans of. And it wasn't like the kids couldn't appreciate it. They could appreciate it. But one kid asked, but why do I think Will Ferrell is so funny and Charlie Chaplin isn't? Because Will Ferrell is your friend. You know Will Ferrell. I'm going back to this point again. Humor is social. It's social. It's social. When you grew up or your parents grew up with Groucho Marx, you saw him on You Bet Your Life. You felt like you knew him. So it became the personality. I was crazy for the Marx Brothers as a kid. And now I watch it and it's okay. It's okay. You know what I mean? You know, crazy word salad stuff like that, that then, you know, S.J. Perlman wrote for them. Woody Allen sort of employs those same types of techniques. Let me put it this way. No humor really functions hundreds of years. You understand it as humor. If you look at the Greek comedy, Aristophanes, you're going to say, oh, I understand it's humor. I see it's sort of funny, but it's not going to knock your socks off.
I remember watching the beginning of Annie Hall with someone in their 20s who didn't think it was funny at all. At the same time, I suspect that same person would still think Blazing Saddles was funny.
Humor is not eternal. So you're saying we'll still, you know, in 2074, you know what I mean? It's of its moment. It's always of its moment. That's why humor doesn't travel very well between countries. You know, you can take an English sitcom, but you're not going to take a German sitcom. Probably there are no German sitcoms. But
right. So essentially, you know, if we're trying to think about what would a stand-up comedian in ancient Rome have said, the odds are good. Very, very good, that we would not be laughing.
There's a few jokes there. You know, they have discovered joke books for going back. I mean, there's an interesting book by Jim Hull called Stop Me If You Heard This One, which is about the history of the joke. And the jokes, they don't have this complicated structure. You know, it's a barber saying, how would you like me to cut my hair? And then the guy who's getting a haircut said, in silence. You know, that type of stuff. So there's humor and stuff like that. And you do understand them as jokes. But they're not going to make you laugh like Louis C.K. or any of the comedians you respond to now.
Bob Mankoff, the cartoon bank started just like, oh, we'll just compile cartoons, computer, and not really think about it. And yet, it's become extremely important over the years.
I've been a gadget guy my whole life, and so I bought the first Radio Shack computer, then the first Macintosh from 1984, the first scanners. I started to scan cartoons and realizing you could store them. And in 1990, I started the cartoon bank well before I thought it was all going to be CDs because they could hold 650 megabytes. And it was all cartoons the New Yorker rejected. And eventually this became a successful company. The New Yorker bought it from me. I was president until 2008, and we scanned all the New Yorker cartoons available. It's very, very important to the cartoonists because the revenue that they get from a licensing a cartoon can often exceed what's actually, you know, paid by the magazine. So I'm very proud of it because it was one of the first ways in which content by contributors was monetized. So go to it and license.
Bob Mankoff, how important is it for a cartoonist to be aware of everything that's going on, reading newspapers, or do you think that a lot of it could come just from your head?
Well, it depends on the type of cartoonist you are. If you're a complete fantasist, going with the tropes and cliches that have existed, but if you want to use some of those cliches for what's going on in the world, whether it's the Tea Party or anything that's occurring in the news today, well, of course you have to read the newspapers. One of the things we've changed is we have a daily cartoon that occurs online, and that absolutely you have to tie into events. So while I said, you know, there's no universal or timeless cartoon, some of them have a relatively timeless quality. Others of them have to be right of the moment of this week and maybe even this day.
But for the New Yorker, of course, you have to be thinking at least a couple of months in advance.
Well, you do. If you can't tell what's going to happen. What if it's seasonal cartoons or Christmas cartoons? Well, you wouldn't necessarily be doing Christmas cartoons now, but you won't be doing them on December 25th. That wouldn't make much sense. You'll be doing it in October and November.
For people who don't know your cartoons and they hear the name, you're the guy who does the dots.
I'm the guy who does the dots. Stippling, pointillism, the Surratt of silliness. For Richard right here now, I'm going to do a little...
You can do something. You want to do it in the book
yeah,
itself?
Yeah, I can do it in the book here. You see, I'm doing... Usually, I mean, I draw in line also, but in the dots, I'm a guy who can actually dot very, very fast. I'm doing this whole, you know, sort of dot line drawing now of me actually writing. I'm going to do that. So this is like the little outline of the cartoon. Now I'm doing my hair. Now I'm doing my glasses. I'm making myself about 40 years younger than I am because what the hell? It's my drawing. Now I'm putting in the dots. I'm doing this a little faster than I would do it. Okay. Now for that, okay. So now I'll write it. Richard, all the best. You can hear that. That's great. Bob Mankoff. Okay, so I could put. I'm going to put in a little bit more dots. Doing that, fill it in, and so that's my drawing. Although I do it, I would do it much more carefully there. So there we go.
And that's it.
And that's it. That's stippling for you.
Bob Mankoff, now you've written this book. Do you have any thoughts of actually writing fiction?
No, I'm astounded by anybody who can just completely make something up. I mean, I half make it up in this blog and newsletter that I write for the New Yorker. So there's a fictional component in the humor, but it's me fictionalized. You know, so I wrote, I got a GoPro Hero 3, the thing you strap to your head, and I played ping pong with it, and I was out at Google, I gave a talk with it. And so I'll write about it, and half of it will be what's actually happening, and then I'll fictionalize some of it. People, it's clear what's fictionalized, you know, I'll say, I got this wingsuit, and then there'll be a picture of me in the wingsuit, that's a Photoshop thing, and then I'll say, I know it costs so much, but there's no fly and I have to pee. You know, that didn't happen. So, not fiction, although in some ways the cartoons are a fiction.
Sure.
You know what I mean? The cartoons are a fiction. But everybody's talents, I guess there are some people who are multi-talented. I'm just very grateful that I'm mono-talented.
Let me ask you this, Bob Mankoff. We kind of get, I guess your humor has somehow merged over the years with the New Yorker humor. So if you were going to talk about a movie, a TV show, comedian that goes to the heart of what makes you laugh, can you give a few examples?
It's selective. Of course, I was always a huge fan as growing up of Woody Allen. Mel Brooks was a big influence on me. Not that they would necessarily make me laugh now, but they become part of my comic DNA and part of my heritage. Some of the stuff that Louis C.K. does, I don't like, but some of it just knocks me out in that his ability to deeply get into the human condition. There's a vileness that I don't like in his stuff, and then there's a stuff where it's so self-deprecating. He is so vulnerable, and he is showing our vulnerabilities. The bits seem obscene, but they are actually not obscene. You know, I love the bit also where he talks about, you know, racism. Yeah, and he starts off by seeming to be racist himself, where he says something like, man, I'm really bummed out tonight. You know, I should be okay. He says, I'm white. And then he talks all about that. So I very much really admire his stuff.
What about Will Ferrell?
Well, Will Ferrell, I didn't grow up with him. You know, Will Ferrell is funny to me, but it's just too much Will Ferrell personality. It's not my type of humor, just this almost campiness, like Anchorman and stuff like that. The thing I resonate to, the Louis C.K. bit is very cognitive. It's really all about ideas. I talk about that in the book. I talk about my contract that I got from the New York in 1980. It didn't mention cartoon. It mentions ideas. I don't see a lot of ideas in a Will Ferrell thing. In a Will Ferrell, and he's a tremendously gifted comedian. There's no question about that. That's all of his talent, his timing, everything. But when all of a sudden he's on Saturday Night Live and he's playing George Bush, we're just getting this tremendous kick of Bush being mocked and Will Ferrell being him. So it's not my thing.
Recognition rather than laughing. It's all fun.
Yeah, well, recognition or just admiring the person so much. For me, it's the content. It's the ideas. It's the craft of comedy that you see in someone like Louis C.K. or even Richard Pryor, people like that. It's one of the reasons I was not ever impressed with Lenny Bruce. He wasn't a great comedian. He was plying the same trade as Louis C.K., but he didn't actually have this tremendous comic chops to me.
What about someone like Larry David?
Well, Larry David, that's a very interesting type of humor. Well, I think the highest level of sitcom ever reached was Seinfeld. That was a clockwork comic. Perfect thing. Larry David's stuff is very interesting, like Louis C.K. revealing our feelings, but it's cringe humor. So there's something about it. It's like going to an amusement park and wanting to be nauseated on a ride. I don't find that as satisfying as the best Seinfeld episode.
Bob Mankoff, any plans for the future? Any new things coming up?
You know, my plan for the future is definitely to keep existing past this biblical limit. My quip about being 70 is, I'm okay, really. Things could be worse. That's the good news. The good news is things could be worse. The bad news is it will be.
You've been listening to an interview with Bob Mankoff. whose memoir is titled, How About Never? Is Never Good for You? My Life in Cartoons. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.